Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
I feel like it's getting darker in here each week, which is some kind of symbol of us progressing through the book. Rest assured, I don't arrange the lighting accordingly, though it's strangely appropriate today. I think these are some of the hardest chapters in the book. Actually, I think I say that every week, but I genuinely mean it. These are incredibly difficult chapters where we look at the seals, the trumpets and the bowls and all these judgments that happen. And there are a number of reasons why I find them difficult. Let me just tell you why I find it difficult. And maybe you'll be like, that's incredibly simple. Or maybe some of you will be like, yeah, I get that as well. So I find it difficult to know what the chronology is meant to be. Is it meant to be literally you have these seven and then the next seven and then the next seven? If so, why does God only work in sevens? It's a little bit odd, but there we go. I find that difficult. I find it difficult to know, like Tom said, actually, how much of this, are we meant to see these as good things or bad things? Are the people good people or bad people? Is it that simple? I find it difficult to know how literally we're meant to read things. I mean, I imagine that not all of it is meant to be read literally for reasons that we will see. But it is incredibly complex. And also I find complex the idea of judgment, and we talked a little bit about that last week if you were here. And I think it's important to bear in mind with these chapters, as well as, well, probably even more so than other chapters we've looked at or will look at in the book, about the idea of judgment. It is a dual thing. It is both God punishing, but also God doing justice more positively. He is putting the world to rights. And I argued last week that the main thrust of the book of Revelation is that God is putting the world to rights and he is dealing with evil once and for all. And when people look at the book of Revelation and say, I don't like this, there's too much punishment. Well, actually, I'd say that for God to be good, for God to be loving, for God to be just, he has to deal with evil properly. If he sweeps it under the carpet, he is an unjust judge. And judgment, I said last week, depends very much on where you're looking at it from. So if you are the victim, then in a courtroom scene when someone passes judgment, when they give justice, actually that's a positive thing for you. Whereas if you're the wrongdoer, obviously it has negative effects on you. And it's just important to bear in mind that dual aspect of judgment as we go through. Okay. I'm stalling. It's scary. Okay, let's get into it. The seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. So far, we've looked at general principles for how to understand the book in week one. Last week, particularly, we saw John's vision of heaven. So if you remember from last week, John is invited into heaven, and he sees this scene over chapters 4 and 5, in which everything in heaven is working correctly. Everything is worshipping God. And so we saw this picture where God is in the center, and you've got the four creatures around who represent all of creation. And then you've got the 24 elders who represent all of the believers in God's creation. And then you've got the angels as well, and there's this worship emanating from the throne. We saw other things like the sea of glass representing chaos and hostility, and that's there at the feet of God. So it's saying, okay, everything that is happening in the world that is negative is under the control of God. Don't worry, it's not chaotic, it's not out of control, it's under his control. And actually we saw these lightning and rumblings emanating from the throne. And as we'll see in the passages we look at today, again and again and again, when it talks about the judgments, it talks about the lightning and the rumblings. And we're meant to remember, no, these didn't just start, you know, arbitrarily around the earth. They started at the throne of God. So God is in control of everything that is going on. And so this week we get to the pictures of the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. And it's striking, I think, that after the picture of heaven, where everything seems to be working well, and you get the sense that God is in control, you kind of expect to turn the page and then everything works, and everything's good, and it's happy. But actually, you turn the page in chapter 6 right to the end, or up to about sort of 19, is pretty bleak. And it seems to be an odd sort of tension. If everything's working well in heaven, why is it not working well here and now? And I think the reason is that John wants us to know that God is dealing with the chaos and the brokenness in the world. He doesn't simply just wipe it out in one go. Actually, he's allowing evil to come to a head, as it were, so that he can deal with it decisively. He doesn't sweep it under the carpet. He wants to deal with it in its entirety and at its worst. And what we're going to do today is we're going to look at these three long sections about judgment. But I want to lay down a few principles that I hope will guide us and help us as we go through. And so I just want to make a couple of comments, and then what I want to do is get you to do some work, and we'll break into groups and we will look at some of these judgments and try and piece together some ideas of what they might be trying to tell us. But I'll give you a few comments first of all. So I said that the chronology of the judgments is a particularly difficult thing to get our heads around. Now, if you remember back to week one, I said there are a whole load of different ways of reading Revelation, and the futurist view will very often see, well, it will see the whole of the book of Revelation really as pointing to the future, things which will happen towards the end of the world. And a futurist reading these passages about seals and trumpets and bowls will typically treat them as chronologically sequential events. So trumpet or seal 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 happens, and then come the trumpets, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And some of them have got complex ways of laying that out so that the seventh seal happens at the same time as the first trumpet. And it doesn't matter. There are loads of different views, but essentially they all see them as being particular events which will happen in a particular order towards the end of time. But there are a number of problems with this view, quite apart from the fact that we saw in week one that I don't think the futurist view is a particularly sensible way of reading the book. I don't think it does justice to what apocalyptic literature is about. I don't think it gives much hope for John's original readers, or in fact even for us today. I just don't think that's what's going on. But there are a number of problems with the view which we will see as we go through. And so a whole load of commentators, and this is the view that I would take, argue for something called parallelism or progressive recapitulation, which basically means this. The seals, the trumpets, and the bowls are not straightforward, chronological, sequential events that will happen. Rather, they recapitulate. They kind of go back over themselves. So you read one, and you kind of get a view of something that's happening throughout the church age. And then you move on to the trumpets, and you look back, and it's recapitulating. It's going back over the same series of events again from a different angle. And then you move on and you get the bowls, and again, it's recapitulating. It's not a new thing that must happen after the trumpets and the seals. It's looking back over the same period of church history from a different angle. And we saw in week one that, well, I argued that the whole of the book is designed to help us wherever we are in the church age, that is, from the ascension of Jesus till his second coming. The whole book is designed to give us a sense of what is going on and how we can understand history in the church age. And that is one of the reasons why I think the recapitulationist position on the seals, trumpets and bowls is most helpful. Let me give you a couple of comments. Recapitulation is actually quite common in apocalyptic literature. If you were to read bits of Ezekiel and Daniel and Isaiah, you would find that they do it quite a lot. Daniel does it particularly. He prophesies about something, and then he prophesies about something else, and actually you realise he's talking about the same thing, or even things that predate it, just from a different order. And commentaries go into a lot of depth, actually, about how Revelation is based on Daniel in this regard. So this is not a new thing. This is something that's quite common to this genre of writing. Secondly, there are similarities between the sets of judgments. It's not like there are 21 completely different judgments. Actually, when you look at them, you see, hang on, the first one there looks very like the first one there. And the third one there looks very like the third one there. And there seem to be patterns, which we will see in a minute as we actually lay them out alongside each other. Also, there are points in the middle of the book where it talks about judgment, and it seems like the judgment is full, is complete, is all dealt with in one go. So, for example, Revelation 11, verses 4 to 18, contains a song in which we are told, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of the Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever." And it says that justice has been done to all God's enemies, and they have been finally punished. And yet we know from the chapters that follow chapter 11, there are still more judgments and more punishments that get dealt out. So it seems that some of the events following this passage may actually refer to the period before the passage. It's not, sadly, as straight and simple as just being able to read it through in chronological order. Also, this is a great example. Could someone read to me Revelation 6, verses 12 to 17? I think it's there in your notes. So the language is vivid. It's pretty graphic. It's pretty difficult. It sounds pretty total, doesn't it? The mountains appear to be removed. It's not clear, after reading this passage, how the world is going to stand another 15 judgments. This is the sixth of the first set. It seems total. So what's going on? Well, what's more, the whole sun, the moon and the stars appear to be destroyed in this passage. And yet if you were to read on in chapter 8, we find that then a third of the sun, the moon and the stars get struck. So if they're all struck and dealt with and gone, and then a third of them get struck two chapters later, it doesn't seem to work chronologically. It doesn't seem to be saying 6 and then 7 and then 8 and then 9 and then 10. Rather, it seems to be saying that the seals, if you understand it from this perspective, it builds to this thing where mountains are gone, the sky is struck, the moon is struck, the stars fall from the skies. Hang on, let me tell you it from another perspective, the trumpets. And then again, it looks over the same events, and it builds again to the point where the sun gets struck and the moon gets struck and the stars fall from the skies. Do you see the chronology doesn't work if we just treat it as something that goes straight through 21 events that we can line up and put in a row? It seems to be looking at the same events from different perspective. And I would argue that we shouldn't get too caught up on the order of the events. The fact that John depicts things happening one after another and the fact that he numbers them doesn't necessarily mean that they follow one another in that strict chronological order. It may be that there is crossover between events, which John has listed in this particular order, and he's just struggled to put it into language. In fact, Tom Wright, a theologian, he gives this analogy, which I find quite helpful. He says, this is one of the key differences between writing something with words and writing it with music. In music, you can have several lines which all happen at the same time, but with words, you have to say everything in sequence. So imagine a piece of music. You may have a particular bass line that's repeated and sort of runs through. You may have a motif going over the top, particular chordal patterns that are repeated in the middle. And essentially, you've got multiple themes happening at once, and you hear it as a whole. And within that as well, particular things evoke particular feelings. So you may have a repeated pattern, which is meant to just make you feel like, oh, I know what's going on here. This is comfortable. I'm used to this. And a new theme is introduced over the top, and the chords may change from major chords here to minor chords. The whole thing just melds together. So you've got this whole load of different experiences going on at once. You can't really do that with writing. And so John writes about things from one perspective, and then another perspective, and another perspective, whereas actually, if he were to depict them without the constrictions and the constraints of words and language, he may sort of meld them all together and get us to experience them in one go. That's the kind of difference here. So Tom Wright says, this sevenfold sequence, 4 down, 3 to go, he says, at the point where he's writing, is not chronological, it's an exposition of a sevenfold reality. So we don't know whether John is meant to be saying, literally, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, or he's envisaging them all coming together. We just don't know. I imagine it's something more like the latter, but we really can't press it for too many details. I don't think we should be too concerned about that. I think we should see the seals, trumpets and bowls as being not in a strict and rigid order. Rather, they are depictions of the whole reality of what will happen throughout the church age. And it's like John is saying, if you see it from this angle, we learn this. If you see it from this angle, now we see something different. And if you see it from this angle, again, you see it in a fresh light. Now, that feels fairly abstract, but I hope when we actually get into the text, that will make a bit more sense. Let me comment a little bit on the language, unless anyone has any questions at that point. Okay? Okay, let me comment about the language. We've already seen that Revelation uses a huge amount of figurative language, where it looks like it's saying one thing and it might actually be referring to something else, and it takes a bit of hard work to get our heads around it. And that is certainly true of these sections. When they speak of horses, I don't think that John literally was saying to his readers, hey, you guys in Laodicea, if you open your window about now, you'll see a red horse running down the street, destroying a third of the world. He's not intending us to literally think that there are going to be horses. Now, some of the things may be quite literal. So when he talks about famine, chances are that's famine. You know, he's talking about that. It's not a highly metaphorical term in the same sort of way as four-coloured horses might be. So we've got to work quite hard at telling what's literal and what's not. It's not always clear. In fact, it's not even clear that the language we just read in that Revelation 6 passage is meant to be taken literally. So the stars falling from the sky, the moon turning to blood, etc. Actually, the Old Testament regularly uses language that sounds like the end of the world to describe things that happen in history. So time and time again, I could give you a whole load. In fact, I think later on in the notes, I have given you a whole load of examples you can look at. It uses cataclysmic sounding language to describe events that mean that history will never be the same again from that point on. here's one, I think, good example. Joel 2, verses 28 to 32, it says this. It shall come to pass afterwards that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your old men shall dream dreams, and your young men shall see visions. Okay, we're kind of familiar with this. Have you heard this before? Yeah, we're kind of used to this one. It sounds quite nice. I like visions and dreams. That's good. Even on the male and female servants in those days I will pour out my spirit, and I will show wonders in the heavens and on the earth. Now, I'm not sure we preached on this bit when we did our Empowered series a couple of weeks ago, but here are some of the signs of this outpouring of the Spirit. Blood and fire and columns of smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And it shall come to pass that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there shall be those who escape, as the Lord has said, and among the survivors shall be those whom the Lord calls. So in this Joel passage, it talks about the coming of the Spirit, and then it describes it as the moon turning to blood and the sun being darkened. And when Peter stands up at Pentecost in Acts 2, he preaches from this passage. And you don't get the people looking around going, "Where, you know, the sun is just dark and the moon's turned to blood." They understand that what he is doing is he is using dramatic, cataclysmic sort of language to say that something is happening, which means that history will never be the same again. In fact, we do exactly the same thing. We talk about events being earth-shattering, by which we don't mean that literally the world breaks into pieces. We just mean something has happened for which the only appropriate language is highly charged metaphor. Things will never be the same again after this earth-shattering event. 9/11, world wars, those sorts of things, earth-shattering. It's just a way of saying that something incredibly dramatic has happened. And if you were to look through some of the examples that I've given you in your notes, you'll find that many of those sorts of verses refer to nations being judged and conquered in the Old Testament. We'll also see, I think, that a lot of the language is chosen for particular reasons, because of its metaphorical or its historical theological meaning, by which I mean in the Old Testament, these metaphors had particular meanings, and maybe John is alluding to a particular story because he wants you to understand that if I'm going to get my head around what is happening in history now, I've got to see it as like a type of what happened in a particular story. We'll see what I mean in just a second as we get into them. But sometimes he's using the language not because he wants you to think this is literally going to happen and it's going to look like this, but rather he wants you to think back to the Old Testament and understand a particular theological point as a result, which we'll see in a moment. In fact, also, he uses the word like again and again and again throughout the book. That's not that he's just got one of those annoying modern ticks that teenagers have where it's just like all the time. He's using the word like again and again and again because he wants you to know that he's not being totally precise in his language. He's not saying it literally happened like this. He's saying it's sort of like this. It's figurative language. Again, I think I've given you some references there to check it out. There's a kind of lack of precision about his language, and he's being open about that. So, I think we should look at the broad themes and the effects and try to understand the theological point that underpins it, but I wouldn't worry too much about the details, by which I'm not saying let's be sloppy in our theology. I'm just saying that if we get too deep into the details without understanding why he is writing this in a particular way, we'll end up plotting charts and thinking this is exactly how when the end of the world is going to go, and we'll end up somewhere where John doesn't ever intend us to go. Details are important, and we can ask questions about the details as we go, but I think actually the theological meanings that undergird his writings are probably more important, and hopefully we'll see that today. Okay. Let's just get into it. Okay, we could talk for hours on end about how to try and interpret it and use that as a good excuse for not actually looking at the passages. But no, let's do it. And in fact, I'd like you to do some work. So, a deep sigh from this side. So Lewis is now going to preach to us on... What I'd like to do is this. I'd like us to break into three groups, and one group will look at the seals, one group we'll look at the trumpets, and one group will look at the bowls. And what I want you to do, without getting too bogged down in the detail, is simply go through, you'll find a kind of blank chart in your notes, go through the references and draw out what is the content of this particular judgment. And then you'll see as well that I've given you Old Testament passages as well, which John seems to be alluding to. So the guys who've got the seals, you're going to be looking at bits in Mark 13. And the guys who've got the trumpets and also the bowls, in fact, will look at bits in Exodus. And what I want you to do is just go through the various verses there, draw out the content of the various judgments and write them in the table. If you find it difficult, there are the answers as well on the back page. But do give it a go. And then at the end, we'll draw it all together and we'll try and figure out what the main point that John is trying to make is. Okay, how did you find that? Interesting? Yeah. Revealing. Can anyone top revealing? Yeah. Earth-shattering. Literally earth-shattering. Wow, great. I'm not sure we're going to beat earth-shattering, so... Isn't it interesting how quickly... I don't know if you found this, but when I... So I did this exercise during the week. I mean, I kind of... I've read lots on it anyway, but I thought, okay, I'm just going to go with the passages and just draw out the content, kind of like I've asked you to do. And then there's only one of me, so that was great fun. A few hours of just sitting there feeling a little depressed as I read through these books. But it was amazing how quickly I wanted to get into the, well, what does this mean? What does this mean? And actually, you suddenly puzzle over those sorts of things, but I just want the content at the moment. And when you get the content down on paper, you start to see patterns that help you to interpret. So I think unless we start to spot the patterns and think, what is it that John is doing here, before we try and get into understanding the details, we'll end up just totally baffled. What does this locust mean with weird things on him? We've got to understand the patterns and what John is trying to do, and I hope that this exercise will help us to do that, though I may be about to be proved wrong. So let's go through and just throw out a few sort of thoughts. I've got all the kind of on the back of your handouts as well. You've got my version of what I've drawn out of the passages. What's roughly the content of the first seal? White horse and bringing war. Okay. And did you get to look at Mark 13:7?
Yeah, war.
War. Okay. So let me give you a bit of background, actually. It seems to be that the seals are based on a passage in Mark 13 where Jesus is asked by his disciples about the signs of the end of the age. And Jesus kind of gives this long list of things that people can expect. No, I'll tell you that in a minute. But it seems to be that John is basing the idea of the seals, or this vision he is seeing, is based on the content of Mark 13. So that's why I'm getting you to look at that passage in particular. And I'll tell you why I think that's relevant in just a moment. But okay, so the first seal judgment is a white horse who brings war. Mark 13:7, war. Second seal judgment?
Red horse starting murder.
Murder, okay. And sort of international... It's a bit of an international conflict sort of feel to it, isn't it? Yeah. Mark 13:8.
Conflict.
And this is going to get quite tedious, isn't it? Because you're all going to go, oh, wow, it's the same as if you're surprised. And we're going through 21 of these. But you see, there's a kind of a parallel between what John is saying and what Jesus predicted in Mark 13. Okay. Seal 3, the black horse, brings
economic problems.
Yep. Sort of famine and injustice. Actually, the black horse, it talks about there being scales, and scales are obviously used for measuring, but particularly in the ancient world, scales were used for measuring food, in rationing and apportioning food. And what we see about the black horse is that the products of wheat and barley are 10 times higher than they were on average in the ancient world. In other words, there's this kind of scarcity of things which is leading to economic injustice because prices are just going up tenfold. And what's fascinating in the passage is that wheat and barley, which are kind of regular things that people would have to eat to get by, they're 10 times more expensive. And so a denarius was a day's wage for a labourer, and that would just about get enough wheat or barley to feed one person. So this guy's going out to work and he's coming home with enough to get food for one, let alone his family. So it's talking about economic scarcity and hardships. But at the same time, we're told that the oil and the wine is unharmed. Now, the oil and the wine are more luxury products. And so part of the result of this famine is there's a sort of greater sense of economic
disparity, I suppose, with the poor or regular people barely being able to feed themselves, and yet the rich just being able to have their wine and their oil. And so it seems to be talking about famine and economic disparity. And there's something of that in Mark 13 as well, although he doesn't go into anywhere near enough as much detail. He talks a bit about famine. Seal 4, the pale horse.
Death by disease and starvation.
And
other things as well, like wild
animals. And wild animals, yes. Which I always find a little bit strange, where it talks about death by wild animals, as if like it's just describing dragons and beasts and then death by wild animals. It feels a little bit odd, but yeah. All that sort of stuff. Mark 13:8, again, similarly, talks about famine. No wild animals, but, you know, similar. Seal 5, what happens there? Yeah.
They're getting
white robes and they're taught to be patient. Okay, so Seal 5, these martyrs are crying out to God for vindication or for justice, and they're given white robes and they're told to be patient because God is, you know, God's got this under control. He has a plan. At Mark 13, 9 to 23, what happens there?
Persecution.
Okay, so it talks about various ways in which believers will be persecuted throughout the church age. Yeah, there seems to be a parallel there as well. Seal 6, what happens?
It's about the sun and the moon and how they're affected, like
So kind of cosmic shakings, the moon, the sun, the stars. Mark 13:24, again, we see the same sort of thing, eclipses and the heavens are shaken, that sort of stuff. Seal 7, silence in heaven, yes. Silence is probably a mixture of things. It probably contains a sense of awe, a sense of waiting, but also silence in the Old Testament particularly seems to refer to God's displeasure or God judging. So, for example, the periods of silence where God refused to speak to his people, that is seen not as just God being petulant, but God in some way saying, I'm judging you, I'm punishing you, I'm withdrawing from you. And then maybe something of that going on here as well, a kind of awestruck amazement at what God is doing, but a sense that this is his final act of decisive judgment. And you kind of get a similar thing about judgment in Mark 13 as well. Okay. Let me just make a couple of comments that help us on that, and then we'll move on. The imagery of the horses seems to come from Zechariah chapter 1, where there are four groups of coloured horses which represent nations that God is raising up to punish his people for their disobedience. And in Zechariah, the story is interesting. These horses, they punish the people, but actually they go too far. They go further than God even wanted or allowed them to. And so God then actually punishes them for their disobedience as well. And in drawing to mind this kind of idea with his coloured horses, John seems to be saying there's a similar thing. These punishments, which were like, are they good, are they bad? Well, in a sense, God is allowing these punishments to come upon people for a reason, but actually there may be a sense in which they go too far, and God will actually end up punishing the punishers as well. So his justice will be utterly done. It's not a free-for-all. There's a kind of a tension between, is this good, or is God allowing it, but the overall message is, at the end, God will have his justice, and evil will not get away with doing whatever it wants, that kind of thing. Tom. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, potentially. So the question was about Habakkuk. You remember in Habakkuk, you get one nation rises up, and it seems that God is actually rising them up to punish his people. But then actually God punishes them for the injustice they have done as well. And that happens again and again as well throughout the Old Testament. Yes, yeah, these things are in God's hand. Whether we're meant to think specifically of Babylon or not is a complex question. I think Babylon as a type of nations who God raises up and then punishes sure. But we'll see probably next week that Babylon comes to mean quite something a bit more specific in the book as well. So, yeah, a good spot.
Can I just ask something? The nations that started off as good and became evil. Because it's saying that the horses represent evil, then also saying the horses represent nations.
Sure. Yeah. So, are they good and became evil? I think we're not meant to see these creatures as good. I mean, if I had to sort of nail it down, I think I'd say that these are representations of disobedient, wicked nations, which God has restrained, but is now allowing to sort of do their worst, in a sense, because he wants to bring evil all to a head so that he deals with it all in one go. So I'd see these as predominantly negative creatures that God is allowing to wreak havoc for a period so that he will judge them all in one go, finally and totally. Okay, we probably don't have time to get into all the details, so I'll move on quickly. We've talked a little bit about the silence. Okay, trumpets. Who did the trumpets? Guys at the back. Right, let's just go through them relatively quickly. Trumpet one, roughly what happens there? Hail, fire, and blood, okay? And they're disasters that seem to particularly strike the land, which is interesting, we'll see in a moment. Okay, Exodus 9, verses 22 to 25. Plague of hail. Yeah, this is the seventh plague in Egypt. If you're familiar with the story, the people of God are slaves in Egypt at this point, and Moses is raised up as a leader to go and set them free, and God inflicts 10 plagues upon them before the Pharaoh eventually lets them free. And this is plague 7, the plague of hail and fire, which seems to be a parallel here to the first trumpet judgment. Okay, the second and third trumpet judgment seem to sort of link to the same Exodus passage. So what was trumpet 2? Sea turns to blood. Okay, so a fiery mountain gets thrown into the sea. Actually, how much of the sea gets turned to blood? A third. Okay, and a third of the sea creatures die. What plague might this be referring to? Sure, the first plague where the Nile gets turned to blood and the fish die. And yeah. Okay, trumpet 3. Okay, so kind of similar to the second one, but this time instead of hitting the seas, it affects the rivers. And so the rivers get struck by the star wormwood, which makes the water bitter and undrinkable. Again, that's similar to plague one in the Exodus, where the water becomes undrinkable. Just a quick comment on the wormwood thing. Wormwood is a herb in the ancient world, which is just incredibly bitter. And actually, if you were to drink water that has been infused with wormwood for a long time, it would be poisonous to you. And wormwood is a picture that is used quite regularly in Jeremiah as a metaphor for bitterness, which has a sort of destructive property on you, and it seems to be something like that going on here. So actually with bits like this, it's not entirely clear whether John is literally trying to say that the waters will become bitter, or that bitterness is somehow a metaphor for spiritual states, attitudes to one another. I don't know. It's really difficult to know. It may well be both. Okay. Trumpet 4. What happens there?
Darkness.
Yeah, okay. So we've moved from disasters on the land to disasters at the sea, then disasters in the river, and then disasters in the sky. So the sun, the moon, the stars all get struck. Again, a third of them get struck. Exodus, what was the ninth plague? Darkness. Yeah, so similar sort of parallel there. Okay, trumpet 5. Locusts. Yeah. And again, a sense of darkness, because there are so many locusts around. Exodus, plague 8. Locusts, yes. Trumpet 6, there doesn't seem to be a parallel in Exodus. I've read a couple of commentators that try and sort of force it. I just don't think there is a parallel there. And I like that, actually, because I like the fact that it doesn't quite fit in a neat table, because that'll be too easy, and God's ways are not like that. But the sixth trumpet, there seems to be this enormous army gathering by the Euphrates, and we'll come to that again in a moment. And then trumpet seven, what happens? Yeah, and loud noises in heaven, that kind of loud voices in heaven. Yeah, yeah. And this seems to be a parallel to Exodus 19, which is not one of the plagues, but is kind of part of the culmination of the Exodus story, I suppose. What happens there? Yeah. Great, so it's the kind of coming of God, the term is a theophany, the Sinai theophany, so the coming of God at Mount Sinai, and the language of lightning, thunder, and earthquakes, and a voice like a trumpet seems to be almost identical there. Okay, great, let me make a couple of comments about that. Trumpets mean a number of things. They indicate a warning of attack in warfare. They're also used to celebrate enthronement when a new king comes to power. And probably both of these are in mind here. So there's a sense in which there is a battle going on, but it results in the enthronement of God, the coming of God on his throne. So these judgments demonstrate God's rule, and they warn people of the need to repent and respond to him. So whereas the previous judgments were like the unleashing of pent-up evil in the world in order that God will deal with it, this seems a bit more like God is being active in his judgments, if I can use that sort of terminology. Obviously, he's active in both, but this seems to be his initiative. It's his declaration of war against the evil that has wreaked havoc and brought brokenness in the world. But notice that here, unlike in Exodus, the damage is limited to a third of the land and the trees and the rivers and that sort of stuff. In Exodus, it seems to be more total than that. So in one sense, it's more limited, but in another sense, it's also increased, because in Exodus, it only hit the things in Egypt, and here it seems to be worldwide. So it's kind of a third of things, but it's a third of things multiplied right around the world. We'll come back to the significance of that in a moment. Bear in mind, with the dimming of stars and suns and moons and that sort of thing, we're not just talking about things that happen up in the sky. We're talking about things that in the ancient world many would have worshipped. And so there's an extra level of symbolism here. It's not simply the things on which we rely for sunlight and vision and telling the time are somehow struck. Actually, these are idols that many people would have worshipped, and God is demonstrating his complete power over them in striking them. The fifth and sixth trumpets are complex. They involve a star falling from heaven, which seems similar to Jesus saying about Satan in Luke 10. And there's locusts and an army. Now, we'll come to similar passages next week, so I don't want to get too much into it, but I'm not avoiding it, honestly. But it seems to be here a hint of the devil's work behind things happening in the world. And hopefully next week we'll clarify it a little bit, but if it seems for the moment, on reading this first reading, that Satan has some sort of power and is in control, I think John doesn't mind you thinking that for a moment, because we're about to see that he doesn't in the later chapters. And so it's sort of setting up this thing where the devil purports to have power, that we will see he actually doesn't when God overthrows him. Okay. Sorry, go for it. Yeah.
Because obviously he's trying to free the Israelites.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying he's causing the ones in Revelation.
Well, I am saying that, actually. I'm saying that with the seals, it was more a case of allowing these horses to run, but that's pent-up evil that's sort of running for a little while before God stamps on it entirely. Here, this seems to be more the active punishment of God. Now, it raises a lot of questions that we don't have time to go into now, but I think the link back to Exodus is for a particular theological reason, which you've alluded to, and it's the fact that God gave these plagues in order to call people to repent and to demonstrate that he was powerful and he was setting his people free. And I think the reason why here, rather than referring simply to Mark 13, John is referring to the Exodus narrative, is he wants you to know, in the same sort of way that the plagues preceded the escape from slavery, so too, when we look at the events in this world, we can understand that they precede the great coming of God and his setting people free. So it's that kind of Exodus motif that we're meant to look forward to the freedom that comes after this difficult time. And it's just two other comments, actually. Firstly, the people had to live through the judgments in Egypt before they received the freedom. And I think it's a similar sort of thing here. It's not that we get escaped, we get taken somewhere else. Actually, we do have to live through difficult times, but the result is God will step in and set us free. And also, what's interesting, in verses 20 to 21, we're told that the people who were not killed by these plagues did not repent of the works of their hand, and they carried on worshipping idols and that sort of thing. And again, like in Exodus, where Pharaoh's heart gets hardened as a result of the plagues, we're left with this kind of tension that many will see these things which are intended to warn them and call them to repentance and coming back to God, and they will actually get harder as a result. Yeah, interesting. Well, I think, so the question is this referring simply to all of mankind who are not believers, or is it possibly referring to all people, like in Exodus, where Pharaoh hardened his heart, yes, but then Moses goes up the mountain and they build a metal cow to worship, you know. I think actually that's an interesting point. The tendency to harden our hearts is a human trait, whether we are Christians or not. And I think actually, right through, we haven't looked at the letters to the churches, we skipped those early on, but one of the themes there is, you guys are not immune from worshipping idols, doing things that take you away from God, and we've got to watch our purity. So I think it is a human trait, and I think we can all fall foul to that. But I think predominantly here it seems to be talking about, because it's talking about murders and sorceries and sexual immorality and theft, and it seems to be talking about people who are not believers, who continue in that way rather than becoming believers. Okay, the bowls, and we'll go very quickly through this because I want to end on a happy note. the bowls. Bowl one. What happens in bowl one?
Boils.
Okay, yeah.
Everyone gets
boils. Does everyone get boils? Okay, in Egypt, boils seem to be widespread. Okay, in Revelation 16:2, it seems to be that the boils, the sores, are related to those who have taken the mark of the beast, and we'll look at what that means next week. Okay, again, the second and third bowls seem to be linked together. So the second bowl is, what happens? Okay, blood in the sea. Does that sound familiar? It's also the second trumpet, isn't it? So we've gone from sort of judgment on the land to now judgment on the sea. And again, it's the same Exodus reference. What's the third bowl? Okay, yeah. So the land, then the sea, then the rivers. Again, this seems to be sort of parallel to the trumpets. How about the fourth bowl? So the bowl is poured on the sun. And then the sun scorches people. Now, this is slightly different. It's not talking about darkness, but it seems to be here the sun having a negative burning effect. And that seems to be the equivalent of Plague 7, the hail and fire coming upon the land and affecting people. Bowl 5?
Darkness.
Darkness, yeah. Where is the bowl poured? I don't know if you spotted that. It's poured. Some of them are poured onto the land, some onto the sea, some onto the sun. These are poured onto the throne of the beast. So it seems to be that there's some kind of judgment that comes upon the enemies of God in particular. And we'll see that the beast is not necessarily a person, but something more, I guess, demonic. We'll see that next week. Okay, bowl 6, the bowl is poured upon the Euphrates, which obviously is a river, and frogs come out and kings from the east attack. Now, it's very clear, actually, if you may want to look at the final page on this and see how these fit together. When you look at the bowls and the trumpets, you see a particular parallel, and they seem to be talking about the same sort of things, but from slightly different angles. The bowls mention frogs, whereas the trumpets don't. There are these frogs, which are obviously like plague 2 in Exodus. And then the seventh bowl, you have thunder, lightning, and an unprecedented earthquake, and this seems to be the end. And again, that's sort of similar to the Sinai thing and trumpet 7. Notice the intensity, the increasing intensity of the judgments. If you were to look at this sort of completed chart with my answers in, you would see that it sort of grows as you move from the seals to the trumpets to the bowls. So first of all, in the seals, you get a quarter of the earth being struck, a quarter of the earth being judged in a particular way. Then you move to the trumpets and you get a third of the earth being struck or judged in a particular way. You move to the bowls, and you get the whole of the earth being struck and judged in a particular way. Now, the reason for this seems to be that John is saying that throughout the church age, there will be a whole load of ways in which God is dealing with the brokenness in the world, and some of them will be more intense and some less intense. But there seems to be an increasing intensity such that we get to the point where finally all evil is dealt with. It's not like God is just punishing pockets of brokenness and evil all around the world. Actually, we get to the point when all of it is dealt with. And that seems to be why John is building this intensity. As before, with the bowls, rather than repenting, many people who suffer the judgments harden their hearts further. So we're told that the judgments will affect those who have worshipped the beast, which we'll look at next week, and they refuse to repent, and they continue to persecute believers. So this leaves us with a tension in the book of Revelation, where on the one hand, the events that happen throughout the church age are designed to bring people back to God, but on the other hand, many of them actually respond by hardening their hearts further. And Phil Moore, whose book on Revelation is really brilliant and really accessible, and I'd highly recommend it, he uses the example of 9/11. And he says that a number of papers called it the day that changed the world. I remember reading headlines like that all the time, the day that changed the world. And undoubtedly, to a degree, it did. And one of the immediate responses to this event, which as an event is just a shocking but amazing demonstration of what atrocities humans are capable of, as a result of that event, many churches saw doubled attendance the next week, as people were suddenly struck with a sense of, oh, wow, there are things that are bigger than me, that are out of my control, and therefore I need to at least consider getting right with God. And so churches all across America saw doubled attendance. However, 4 months on, church attendance had gone back down to the pre-attack levels. And one researcher, David Kinneman from the Barna Group, wrote in August 2006, now, 5 years removed from that fateful day, spiritually speaking, it's as if nothing significant ever happened. People used faith like a giant band-aid, and it was discarded after a brief period of use. One of the odd tensions of life in the church age is that sometimes things happen that draw people back to God, and sometimes things happen that harden people more towards God. C.S. Lewis talked about pain and suffering as being God's megaphone for rousing a deaf world, which is great, but actually, if you're anything like me, you will know that many people who hear this megaphone actually just block their ears further. But the point is that for the church, whatever the response of people throughout the church age, we are still called to faithfully preach the gospel, try and bring healing for hurt, and try and win people back to God to say, come on, there's a better way. And this story is going somewhere. And we don't have time to talk about natural disasters now. I think I've given you a link in there to a talk I've done at a youth festival, which you may find helpful. But one of the problems is that very often we look at history and the things that are happening to us and we treat them like individual events. And so we say, how could God allow that? Or how could God allow that? Whereas what Revelation does, it says don't treat them as individual events. You've got to see them in a narrative which is going somewhere. And so the question, how could God allow that? I understand the force of that question, but maybe there's a better question to be asking, which is, what is God doing about that? And the point of Revelation is that we are on a trajectory to God dealing with all the pain and suffering and brokenness in this world forever and making a new world in which there are none of those things. We don't have time to look at chapters 10 to 11, but this, I think, is a picture of how the church is meant to be through the church age, and maybe if we get a bit of time at the end, I can touch on that, or we can ask questions. But let me make a couple of comments about Armageddon, since this is a phrase that is thrown around quite a lot, and is a key term and a key feature in a lot of literature and pop cultural references to Revelation. It has little to do with Bruce Willis. You will either be saddened or glad to know. But the sixth and the sixth trumpet and the sixth bowl are particularly confusing because they speak about this gathering army coming from the east. Actually, why doesn't someone read Revelation 16, verses 12 to 16? Again, I think they're in your notes there.
The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. Then I saw three evil spirits that looked like frogs that came out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. They are spirits of demons performing miraculous signs, and they go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them up for the battle on the great day of God Almighty. Behold, I come like a thief. Blessed is he who stays awake and keeps his clothes with him, so that he may not go naked and be shamefully exposed. Then they gathered the kings together to the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon.
Right. I've always been suspicious of frogs. As a kid, I remember looking at them and thinking, you are odd looking, and now I know why. Okay. Leaving aside the frogs, the demon frogs, the dragon, the beast, and the prophet for a moment, which we will come to next week, with the exception of the frogs, which I'll just leave you to guess about. Let's think about Armageddon. Futurists often claim that there is going to be a particular battle which will happen at a particular place called Megiddo, which is in the Middle East. And they base it on this. Because the word Armageddon is a Greek form of two Hebrew words, Ha and Megiddon. Ha being Mount, so it's Mount Megiddo. And this seems to be referring to a particular place in the Middle East. But there are a few oddities about this passage which hint that John is doing something a little more metaphorical here. So we know that Megiddo is an actual place, but there are no mountains there. It's not built on a mountain, it's built on a flat plain. And so he might be referring to Megiddo, sure, but it's not a mountain, so there must be something specific that he's doing here. In chapters 14, 20, and 28 to 9, John seems to place this final battle outside Jerusalem, which is actually a 2 days' walk south of Megiddo. So again, you've got to wonder, is he doing something literal or metaphorical here? Joel 3 speaks about a similar end times battle, which he says takes place in a valley, which he calls the Valley of Decision or the Valley of Jehoshaphat, which means the Lord will judge. So the Valley of the Lord will judge. So it seems to be maybe that John is referring to this plain, Megiddo, but he wants to get you to think about the Joel 3 references, and so he makes it sound like it might be in a valley because he talks about mountains. He seems to be playing with metaphors. Also, Megiddo was known in the Old Testament as a well-known battlefield where Israelites have been attacked at various points in their history, and you can check out some of those references. So it seems that rather than speaking about a particular place, John is conjuring up the idea of a battlefield because he wants to say there is something like a war coming. And so he picks a place that was well-known for being a battlefield. But because he wants to connote the ideas of God judging in a final way, he also starts to bring in other metaphors to remind you of Joel 3. And also, he's therefore saying, this is not a particular place. You're not meant to be going to Mount Megiddo and thinking something specific is going to happen here. You're not specifically meant to avoid it on your holiday destinations, just in case. I mean, he's saying, think about Megiddo. This is a battlefield place, but I'm not saying it's literally going to happen here. He seems to be doing something more metaphorical. The Euphrates River was Rome's eastern border, and it was from there, from that direction, that armies had threatened throughout history. So again, the mention of the Euphrates conjures up the idea of threat and battle. So John appears to be talking about all evil being drawn into one place, and I think that's the key thing, all evil drawn together for a final decisive act of judgment, which will deal with it once and for all. And we'll see what that looks like when we get to later chapters. Okay, that's all quite heavy, but I'd like to end on a happy note. So, what about the church? How are we meant to understand our place in this picture throughout the church age? What happens to us? Well, I think the answer can be found in chapter 7. You may find it helpful if you've got a Bible to open to chapter 7. We won't have time now to read it, but chapter 7 begins with this picture of four angels holding back four winds. Now, this indicates that the angels are holding back judgments that are to come on the earth. And the four winds probably here refer to the four horsemen of chapter 6. And so chronologically, chapter 7 probably comes earlier, before any of the judgments have actually happened. In fact, we're told the angels won't allow the judgments to come until the servants of God have been sealed. Now, seals, they represent two things. They represent ownership, and they also represent protection. And so here we're being told that the people of God are going to be sealed in order to say who they belong to and the fact that they are protected. The 144,000 are marked out as God's own, as opposed to those who have the mark of the beast, which we'll come to next week. But also the seal is a promise of protection through the difficult times. And in Ezekiel chapter 9, there's a similar thing that happens where an angel puts a mark on the foreheads of believers, which then protects them when the Babylonians attack. So John seems to be saying the same thing is going on here. Now, there's a preacher called Andrew Wilson who's great, and he uses a brilliant illustration for this. He says his mum makes the best marmalade in the world, which I would contest. I haven't tried his mum's marmalade, but I think my mum makes the best marmalade in the world. But anyway, it's a good illustration nonetheless. He says that his mum's marmalade is sealed in two ways. She has a particular way of sealing it in the jar that is just recognisable. He said he could be anywhere in the world, and if he suddenly just saw this jar, it's just so distinctively sealed, he would go, hang on, that's my mum's marmalade. It's got a sense of ownership that you recognise who it belongs to. But also he says the seal does more than that, because it actually protects the contents. And so he says in their garage at home, they've got jars of it that date back decades, which I find a little bit weird, but he still says is good. But the seal does something to protect the contents, such that even if the outside of the jar gets damaged or worn over time, the contents, the stuff inside, remains protected. And I like that as an image for what happens to us. We are like jars of marmalade, which get stamped with God's seal. The 144,000 are marked out as God's people, but also there's this promise that whatever happens to our exterior, whatever happens when we face difficult times, God is promising to protect the essence of us. He's promising to carry us through the difficult times. Not that we avoid them, but when we go through them, there's a level of protection that God promises. But who are the 144,000? Well, loads of suggestions have been offered. Some have argued that they are ethnic Jews who will be saved before the end of the world. Others that they're a special category of Christians. Some have treated it as a literal number. Jehovah's Witnesses, particularly. I think, like most numbers in Revelation, it's meant to be understood metaphorically. So 144,000 is 12 times 12 times 1,000. It's the fullness of the people of God. And it's a large number. So actually 12 times 12 is 144. That sounds like a pathetic number. Sounds like God only has a very small number of people who worship him. So they lock the number 1,000 on at the end, because 1,000 was probably the biggest number they had to play with in this ancient world. So 144,000 is a big number that represents the fullness of the people of God. And actually, if you look at chapter 21, you find that 12 and 144 are used metaphorically in this sort of way. This is a picture of the whole people of God. And then get this, like in chapter 5, and remember chapter 5 where John is told there's the lion root guy, and he turns round having heard about this lion root, expecting to see a lion, and then he sees something completely different, which then changes his expectations. You know, he's expecting to see a lion, he sees a lamb. The same sort of thing goes on here. So you read chapter 7, and it describes him hearing this 144,000. But then when he turns round, he doesn't simply see 144,000. Verse 9, he sees a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language. So he's got this idea in his head, I'm about to see the fullness of the people of God. He may be thinking 144,000. When he sees it, it is bigger than anyone can count. What's more, it is drawn from all nations. So this is a picture here of the people of God being multinational and being absolutely enormous. And we're told that it is these 144,000 who no one can count. In other words, that's a metaphor, it's far bigger. we're told that it is these people who are sealed by God. And it's probable, although John doesn't say it here, but thinking of the New Testament as a whole, that the seal has something to do with the Holy Spirit. So Ephesians 1, 13 to 14 tells us that the Spirit seals us as a guarantee of the inheritance to come until we take possession of it. And I think there's probably something of that going on here as well. All believers are sealed with the Spirit, marked out as God's, and promised protection. So the message of Revelation 7 is that throughout the church age, whatever comes, wherever it comes from, believers ought not to expect an easy exit. It's not about Christians escaping the world or getting away from the pain and suffering, but by virtue of living in a broken world, which God is working to put right, we will experience pain and difficulties, and in some cases, martyrdom. That's what we see here. But if you are in Christ, you are sealed. You are known by God. He has put his mark on you. You are his, and he promises to protect you. If you have put your trust in the death and resurrection of Jesus to reconcile us to God, you are sealed, and God will protect you eternally. And of you and me and all the believers, it will be said this, Revelation 7, verses 14 to 17. And with this I end. These are they who have come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst no more. The sun shall not strike them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. I just find that a beautiful passage, because actually, chapter 7, it's come before you've even read about some of the trumpets and the bowls, and the fact that people will hunger, because there's not enough food to go around, and people will thirst, because wormwood will be in the water. And we're told here that for God's people, when he finally rescues them, making the world right, they will not hunger, they will not thirst, they will not weep. Death will be done away with. This is a promise of a glorious future hope.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.